So, it is 5 o'clock on Tuesday. So, welcome. You're listening to KDVS 90.3, and it is time for Office Hour. Before we begin, I want to remind you that the views that are contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, happy to take you on another ride for Office Hour. And before I begin, I just want to give a quick shout out to Jocelyn, to Rick, Benjamin, and all the other wonderful listeners who donated so that when I came today, the lights were on and there was space for us to have the pretty wild, I think, and interesting intellectual conversation we're going to have today. So, as always, we go out knocking. Here I am knocking. Can you hear me knocking? On a door, checking on someone's office hour here at Davis. What are all these professors doing? Here we're on public affairs. So we're going around and we're checking on professors and students and then graduate students in their offices. And we'll be having some undergraduates talking about their research later this quarter. What's everybody up to? What are they thinking about? And I'm very excited today to have David Simpson from the English department with us. So first, I want to welcome you. Welcome to Office Hour.
Thank you.
Right. And we're going to be talking about his hot off the press book. It is so hot, I think the ink hadn't dried when it came in the mail to me. States of Terror, History, Theory, and Literature from the University of California.
Chicago.
University of Chicago, right, Press. Professor Simpson is the author of many other books, a distinguished professor of English here on our campus, most recently of Romanticism and the Question of the Stranger. And strangers may come up today, but primarily we're going to be talking about the power of words and how we can think about the power of words in our life. And the word we're going to be talking about is terror, which is a very important word, as well as potentially a kind of frightening word for us for today. But as always, we start off our conversation interested in how people become the professors that they are. How is it that somebody becomes committed to, for example, spending their life reading romantic literature or making a commitment to be an English professor? So can you tell us, David, a little bit about how you ended up where you ended up, a distinguished professor of English?
Well, that's a very long story. I thought you were going to ask me how I ended up with terror, which would have been rather easier.
Well, we want a little bit of the big story first.
Well, is there a big story? You know, kids who like to read and get rewarded for it tend to carry on reading. Mm-hmm.
So the enjoyment of reading just seeming like this is a good thing. I like doing this. I'm going to...
Thinking about reading,
and I'm going to build my life around that. And certainly from the number of books that you cite in here, you've done a lot of reading. So then what, if you're interested in reading, and what brought you then in particular to the question of terror?
Well, that particular segment of my life began with 9/11, which was a bolt from the blue intellectually as well as in many other ways. Mm-hmm. And my first object of attention there was commemoration. I wrote a book about 9/11 and the culture of commemoration because I was interested in the kinds of memorial culture that developed around the events. And that spun out into a number of other issues, all 9/11 related, remotely or proximally. And the terror one was sitting there really ever since the first days after the attacks, when I couldn't believe at the speed with which what had happened turned from an attack on America to a war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be tracked quite accurately, almost by the hour, in terms of the media and the politicians, choosing their vocabularies at that time. And the war on terror has set a rhetorical model, which I think has not left us. Obama tried to turn it around by insisting that what we were dealing with was terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
But he was then undercut by the Benghazi events, which undid all the good work he'd done rhetorically in trying to focus people's attention away from something metaphysical like terror and towards something more empirical like terrorism.
Something you can study and fight, as opposed to something that's just this global existential fear.
It's just a voodoo word.
A voodoo word. How fast, I'm curious, do you think it was? Would you say that the sort of that shift for the sort of the embalmment of the event as a existential terrorist fear, would you say it happened when you're talking about it in terms of a question of days?
I think it began with days. I think it was solidified within weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I think it soon achieved consensus, you know, which by which I mean TV and newspapers decided to use the word over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But I was particularly interested and still am in how the word horror was never used.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are a semi-distant spectator of something like the collapse of the World Trade Center, it's arguable that you would feel that what you would feel would be better described by horror than by terror.
Mm-hmm. With the idea that you're making the distinction there, that horror is something that you watch from the distance, which is how most of us saw the towers fall.
Exactly.
And terror is something that would be more restricted to those people who are actually in or near the buildings.
Exactly. And so what happens when you get rid of horror, and the word was never mentioned, or it was mentioned very early and it disappeared. And I think that there's an unconscious and insidious strategy to that, which makes it impossible for people to think that they might have a choice about what word they use here and what attitude they adopt. Because the insistence that what you will feel is terror at the spectacle of terror and the generation of terror basically puts everyone together in the position of victim or potential victim, as opposed to establishing degrees of danger,
right,
whereby the person sitting in Omaha, Nebraska is not actually experiencing the same risk as the person sitting inside one of the towers.
They would say, that's horrible, but I wasn't personally terrified.
Exactly.
I wasn't personally under
threat.
Exactly,
and there's all kinds of problems with this. One is ethical. I think it's arguably an ethical mistake, a flattening of the graduated responses that were available or enforced at that time to suggest that what I'm feeling 1,000 miles away is something the same as what someone inside the building is feeling. That's just nonsense. That's nonsense ethically and descriptively and in every way. But of course, terror is a far more potent word if you want to mobilize a population into stupor and passivity, which I think is what the media response, political response to 9/11 was largely doing.
Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about in the broadest category is the power of words, the way in which can we think about the words that we use. And I just wanted to pause for a moment and point out, when people ask what is the value of the humanities, we may be seeing a moment here where one of the things that the humanities can help us do is stop and think about the words that we're using and sort of try to investigate them instead of just being wrapped up in them. And so if we're starting off with this idea of after 9/11, the invocation of terror, you cite this work by Mark Redfield, who says that, for the fancy term, the exemplary speech act of sovereignty for our era is the invocation of terror, which means that the way in which the government makes itself into the government and mobilizes it and mobilizes us as citizens, the number one thing that the government will do will be to talk about terror. And because that is a mechanism through which the government can manufacture consent.
Yes.
So that's kind of the starting point that we start with. So then you take us on a long and interesting journey to go back and step back from that modern consent that government gets through using terror and say, how did we get to be here? Right. Now, you go very far because you go back to Homer. So I would like you to tell us a little bit to help us understand the study. How did you decide how far to go back in this history? And how did you pick the examples? It would seem to me that the word terror is probably in a very large number of texts.
You're absolutely right. And of course, the answer is in a very amateur and impromptu way, simply by feeling my way from one thing to another. and beginning to hold together groups of concerns or conceptual clusters which seem to me to have something in common. And so there's no, you know, in order to know what I should have read, I would have had to already have read everything and to be able to decide what to put in and what to leave out. Clearly that did not happen. But it is a very interesting problem, and I'm afraid I'm an old-style scholar in that respect. I just follow my nose mm-hmm. and dig as deep as I can with whatever resources I have. I don't have any claim to fully comprehensive survey.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the greatest hits of terrorism.
Yeah, exactly.
And also ones that led from one to the next.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. I was curious as to whether you feel your methodology has shifted. Because you do a lot of word searches.
Yeah.
So just for our listeners, if you go through the book, you have a lot of detailed information about what words are used and how many times terror appears in different documents.
Yeah.
And I imagine there may have been a time when people just read through them and counted.
Yeah.
But this is something which we're much more able to do than we used to.
It's interesting you should ask. I mean, I'm very low-grade digital scholar and not able to do many things with the tools that we have now. Younger people, I think, are much better at that. And I have younger colleagues who are terrific at this stuff. You know, people in the Stanford Literary Lab are doing very, very sophisticated work with digital search engines. There are some of the books I write about that have been digitally searched,
mm-hmm.
but there are others where I've simply gone through and read them and made notes every time I see the words terror or terrible or terrific. And so there's a mix. For me, it's just been a hodgepodge of very old style scholarship.
You are your own computer.
Yes. Well, or Drudge. But, of course, even with the computer, you've still got to go back and see how those words sit.
Absolutely.
In the sentences in which they're used. So incidence tells you one thing, and that was very interesting reading the Gothic novel in the 1790s. I could see exactly how much there was of horror and how much there was of terror and what they were doing with it.
Hmm.
And so the digital resources were a very quick way to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But since I read a lot of those books anyway, cover to cover, I was doing the same work twice over in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that's an important point to make, and I appreciate that in order to do the kind of ambitious study that you're trying to do, word searches are not enough.
No.
And you really do have a sense of the fact that you have read through them and have a contextualization.
Yeah.
So I just think, again, as a moment for us to think about the limitations or the way in which computers supplement, but then just having somebody like you who's just had a lifetime reading a lot of this literature and your capacity to really make sense of it. So if we go back then and we see that now your task is to look at this word and its appearance, you go to Homer, you talk about the King James. It's all extremely interesting, and there are many interesting examples, but I think there are more examples than we can actually cover in one interview.
Sure.
So the example that I wanted to go to was the one where you talk about the terror,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, is the French Revolution,
mm-hmm.
and how we now find the idea that for the state to possess the power of terror is simply what a state does.
Mm-hmm.
And if a state wasn't able to be the source of power, that would be, then you of terror in particular, then you would say it wasn't really a functional state.
Exactly.
And now it seems to me part of this is not new.
No.
That part of the role of the state is to have a certain kind of control over terror.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So why do we suddenly find, and I think this is an interesting and complicated question, terror with a capital T, as you talk about. Now we see terror sort of personified in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we understand that coming at it, as you have, from this long history of a lot of state terror in different forms?
Mm. You raise a lot of questions. I'm not sure I can get to them all before you want to ask another one. But take that issue of capitalization. That is a punctual moment. That is the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sort of piece of malign genius in lots of ways on the part of political history, because the power of the state to dispense terror is, as you say, right there right from the start. And it's explicit in, say, Hobbesian state theory.
Yes.
But it's implicit in a lot of other stuff, including the rhetoric of Louis XIV's oath of office, which promises to bring terror to his enemies.
Yes. You know?
It's with the revolution that the terror is invented, and it's invented critically after the fall of the Jacobins. Hmm. In other words, there is the rhetoric of terrifying and terror going the round, but it isn't the major thing that it's been made to be by subsequent literary history. The terror was actually invented by the Thermidorians who toppled the Jacobins, partly to demonize their predecessors, but more importantly to disguise their own terror that was going on at the same time as they were denouncing the other one. In other words, you had a white terror being carried on at just the moment that the red terror was being discredited.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, as so often, history is written by the winners. And so forever after, the Jacobins have been associated with the terror. The second piece of intelligent malignity here is that the Jacobins were, in fact, operating in the classical tradition of statism by using terror, insofar as they did, to establish their own power, their own control of the power of violence.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, if I control life and death, I am the state.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I have the power of life. That's why I'm the state, because I have the power of life and death. But they have been presented retrospectively as a bunch of kind of nasty radicals.
Out of control.
Yes, who in fact weren't the state, but were some kind of upstart faction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, there's something of both, but it's a brilliant piece of conjuring, verbal conjuring, that has established terror as the property of the Jacobins while forgetting that they were actually aspiring to construct themselves as an efficient state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to do with the disavowal of state terror that is going on now, particularly by the countries most able and, in fact, most actually deploying it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, no one will talk. We all know, if we do the digging and we go around and talk to people who live under drone surveillance or whatever, you know, we know that the U.S. has the power of terror.
Mm-hmm.
But the rhetorical definition of Americanness at the moment is entirely as the actual or possible victim mm-hmm. of terror coming from outside. And that's a strange kind of another conjuring trick.
Yes, another one.
Which is supplemented by something that has changed between the Hobbesian state and the Bush state, which is the promise to provide security.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we go into the Bush one, I just want to go back very quickly to this example, because I think it is so interesting. How do they win? A tremendous rhetorical power of saying, as you say, states were always doing terror, but suddenly at some moment, one group is able to label another group as the source of terror
mm-hmm.
and label it successfully. So you find it in Wikipedia, mm-hmm. you find it in sort of mm-hmm. general discourse for a long time after mm-hmm. that. And I think that moment may be worth pausing over mm-hmm. for a minute, because it does model for us things that, as you say, we're going to see similar types of moves made from that period on, where people kind of do what I would call almost a sleight of hand, where you cover over your own terror by saying, look over there, those people, those are the terrorists. And that actually does seem to work. So maybe if we go back to that example and you can unpack it a little bit more for us, how come they were so able, they were so successful at that? Do you have a theory of that?
I couldn't give you a detailed historian's answer. But it would be a version of history being written by the winners. That is to say, particularly with the reconstitution of Europe in 1815, and before that, the alliance against the French, which was willing to use any and every rhetorical tactic to keep its armies, you know, in the field, or help keep its armies in the field. You know, the modern equivalent of that would be super PACs and pouring money into elections and gerrymandering and all the other things we know goes on around electioneering in our own country.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply power. Mm-hmm. And language is a form of power.
Absolutely.
In the wrong hands, in fact, in all hands.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a level playing field. Those of us who are interested in using language as a critique of power have a much harder task.
Yes, it's a much more uphill climb.
Because we don't have Rupert Murdoch to help us out.
Right.
Or Fox News.
We're not sure what we're the winners of.
Exactly.
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 So I just want to go back to one more point about the French before we move forward,
yeah.
Because I think that this chapter was extremely interesting. One of the things you point out is that a lot of the literature that was written at that time did not take this view.
Yes.
So that we find Dickens and other novelists giving a different point of view.
Yeah.
Do you think that says something about novelists? Do you think it's sort of that novelists have a freedom to use words that other people may not have in the culture?
I wouldn't be quite that essentialist, but I would say that the genre of the novel may require or encourage that kind of use of words. But it isn't just the novel. I mean, the kind of fastidiousness I'm seeing, I'm writing largely about the novel because I know about it.
Right.
You know? But it was a big surprise to me to find Edmund Burke, who is the kind of conservative icon of the anti-French lobby in the 1790s, refraining from excessive use of the word terror. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you go to the anti-Jacobin magazine, they're doing it all the time, you know. So that's a rather different reason. It's not because he's a novelist. It's because he understands that to allow France to claim the power of terror is, in fact, to establish them as the state they want to be,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
But the British response was really manifold. And in the Gothic novel, which I write about, they make fun of it. You know, it becomes a kind of spooky genre in which, you know, the wind opens shutters and curtains rustle and then things go bump in the night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Gothic novel is basically a kind of horror show.
more comedic horror
exactly.
show. A much more digestible.
Yeah. Now with Dickens, again, Dickens is interesting because Dickens is not a social radical. He's a liberal, a reformist liberal, but he's aware enough that the issue of what caused the French Revolution and what it was all about is sufficiently complex that you can't just dismiss it as an act of terror.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you read Tale of Two Cities, the word barely occurs.
Right.
Dickens, I think, consciously or not, understands that this would be a dog whistle word that would distract readers from, or hearers, because he went around reading the novels as well, distract readers from thinking hard about what's actually going on in Paris in 1789.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Dickens' attitude to the mob, so-called, the Parisian mob, the crowd, is surprisingly compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he doesn't think there are some bad eggs, he certainly does, but his sympathy is not with the aristocracy, not at all.
So you have strange bedfellows.
Indeed.
You have some very conservative political thinkers who don't want to describe this as terror because, as you say, they don't want to give that kind of power to the people who they're opposing. Then you have the novelists like Dickens who are also opposed to using the word terror because they have a story that they want to tell, which is a different story.
They don't want
it's
to
the
demonize.
Story of mm-hmm. democracy in some form.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything that we can learn from this for the modern example? Is there anything that we can see from these counter uses of terrorism, people who don't jump on the terror bandwagon?
Mm.
That's why I was curious about my previous question was sort of like, well, are there novelists? Is there anything we learn from these strange group of bedfellows that might give us some insight into how to avoid getting onto the terrorist bandwagon today?
Well, I think the answer goes back to what you were asking earlier and what I was saying earlier. In order to succeed, we would have to have power. In other words, in order to enforce and fund a rhetorical victory, a media triumph, say replacing something as simple as replacing terror by terrorism,
mm-hmm.
or replacing terror by horror, these sound very simple things when we're all sitting around in a like-minded way being reasonable. But they are not, in the public sphere, they're not, that reasonableness is not the criterion. Mm-hmm. It's money, it's power, it's influence, it's spectacle, it's whatever you can summon up to win for your side to win.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's tremendously difficult
yes.
to understand how important it is not to restrict terminologies or conversely expand them in unscrupulous ways in the way that's happened with terror.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do see that Dickens does have a kind of power,
yeah,
which is the power of the novelist.
And he, more than most,
exactly.
given his popularity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was able to use that space. Again, you don't want me to essentialize too much and say that all novelists, because I'm sure there are novelists who are happy to write much more standard terrorist novels.
Yeah.
But for some novelists, it was possible. And there was also some, and this I think is, again, an interesting question. There were some political figures who also didn't want to jump on the terrorism bandwagon. So yeah. that may be something mm-hmm. we just sort of want to mark in mm-hmm. our minds and mm-hmm. see who are the people mm-hmm. and what other types of forms of conservatism mm-hmm. or political discourse are there that mm-hmm. don't want to jump on this bandwagon? Mm-hmm. And do we find any of those in the modern mm-hmm. situation? So, but we have...
Well, the poets, certainly the record of post 9/11 poetry is very strong. But, you know, people in the literary world have a kind of respect, affection for interest in the language that is not common. And, you know, by the social positioning of people like us, we are not listened to.
Mm-hmm,
when
mm-hmm.
you have talk shows about political crises, you don't have somebody talking about the political rhetoric that's being deployed.
Mm-hmm.
You have, you know, you have your green corner and your blue corner, and they go at it, and it's a 5-minute segment, and it's all over.
that's right.
I mean, the paucity of discussion of 9/11 on the mainstream media was something between disgusting and disappointing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the people, and I'm not plugging my own case, but, you know, people who would have said what I am saying
mm-hmm.
were not put on television.
Mm-hmm.
We're not given major editorials in the newspapers.
That's right. I think your pointing to poetry is very useful, actually. and I think we will come back to poetry when we're still at the French Revolution. We're going to try to get up into the...
Okay.
But first, we're going to take a break because we've come to the first half of Office Hour today, talking with David Simpson from the English Department with his book about his book, States of Terror, History, Theory, and Literature. So we're going to take a quick break for some public service announcements, and then we will be back for the second half of Office Hour. So stay tuned. So welcome back to the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we're moving our way through David Simpson's States of Terror, History, Theory, and Literature. So the first segment was mostly about the French Revolution, and I want to turn now to sort of what seems to be the major shift that you talk about in the subsequent chapters, which is terror now being something that is not done by the state, but terror is now done by people who are opposed to the state. And then it seems that part of that switch is that terror is taken away from the state, and it seems that the state, almost by definition, would you say, no longer does engage in terror.
No longer acknowledges engaging
exactly.
in terror. I mean, it certainly, most certainly does engage in terror constantly. I mean, this is all to do, well, it's not all to do, but it has to do with the invention of the word terrorism, which, unlike terror, which I follow through its various translations and options from English versions of Aristotle through the King James Bible, et cetera, as you said, unlike terror, terrorism can be precisely located as a neologism in late 1794, and it appears almost simultaneously in French, German, and English, and very soon thereafter in Spanish and Italian, and then gradually in other languages as time goes by, much later in some than others. And so it's that invention of terrorism that allows the burden of violence with the stem word terror in it to be located as the property of dissident or radical minorities,
mm-hmm.
those who are, in fact, against the state. So one could say, if one were putting it in a one-liner, and I wish I'd thought to do this, I didn't, that terror, state, the silence on state terror is maintained by identifying terrorism as committed against the state.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
see? And this has gone on in many forms, back and forth through the 19th century. But its real, its exemplary modern moment is the Palestinians. Mm. And the demonization of the Palestinians as deploying a Marxist-funded terrorism campaign. Mm-hmm. So you had, you're able to kill two birds with one stone. You could blame the Russian state, not the Americans, but the Russian state, and you could nobble the Palestinians at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the book that does this is a key publication in 1985, edited by none other than Benjamin Netanyahu,
mm-hmm.
called Terrorism, How the West Can Win.
So optimistic title.
Well, not just that, but it performs in a kind of a breathtakingly vulgar sleight of hand. It's not intellectually very tip-top, but it, boy, is it effective.
Yes.
And it's generated a whole literature.
Yes.
Leaving the Palestinians aside for a moment, about other distant minorities as now the exponents of terrorism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But Netanyahu says, you know, Netanyahu actually and his co-writers identifies the West as precisely that which is under attack by terrorism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then by definition is not itself deploying terror.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet, of course, we know that there's no more comprehensive surveillance state in the world than Israel, and that America is cheek by jowl with it.
So two things have happened here, which are each fascinating. One is the sleight of hand to take terror away from the state.
To pretend that it's not doing it.
Right.
Yeah,
and I don't understand how that happens. Because, you know, if you think about it, the state
Nobody's
is still
paying attention.
Doing the same
yeah, no.
things it
exactly.
did before that were called
exactly.
terror
exactly.
and were understood to be part of the function of
right.
the state.
Right.
So
right.
I find that part very mystifying.
It's breathtaking. And it's, you know, it, as you sit and talk about it, it's obvious that only the state can maintain the power of violence at such a level as to be comprehensively able to deploy the power of terror.
Mm-hmm.
I, as a radical group member or lone wolf, may have a bomb in my briefcase, and I may blow it up, and I may kill people. But that's very different from the sustained ability to deploy the power of terror, which is to make people terrified about what can happen to them anywhere, any second.
And that's most likely to be the state.
Yeah.
But so why is there some way in which in this sleight of hand where you take terror away from the state, is it partly by a redefinition of what terror is? It seems to me that there is a kind of way in which you ask, if you just ask people, maybe ask my students words they associated with terrorism, they might say random, mm-hmm. for example.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a word.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't think of state violence as being random.
Exactly.
So that may have something to do with
yeah.
the way in which terrorism was repackaged.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just that normal run-of-the-mill oppression of the government doesn't seem terrifying in the sense that it's expected.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, and there's a whole other side to this, which we haven't actually talked about, but which you obviously know, and is that terror is an emotion.
Yes.
You know, I mean, Lev Brzezinski said it marvelously. He said, what have we done? We've declared war on an emotion.
Yes.
And it's that bifocal nature of terror that it is both the power that's applied from outside and the thing you feel when it's applied.
Mm-hmm.
So the point of terror is to cause terror. It's precisely replicative,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so you can then relocate the instance of terror, any point on the spectrum from personal anxiety or extreme personal anxiety to personification at the other end.
And then you need the state for something new.
Yeah.
You need the state to be the strong father that
yeah.
protects you. Do you think any of this has to do with the shifting role of the state? You mentioned the fact that to argue against very powerful rhetoric, sometimes we needed something like the supernatural. You know, you need a very strong counter rhetoric for a rhetorical stance. And maybe supernatural wasn't going to make it. And just the state itself needed a kind of reinvigoration. So the reinvigoration of that what we really do is we protect you from other people seemed even more powerful than saying we can also set off nuclear weapons ourselves.
Yes, exactly. And this goes back to something I mentioned earlier that we left aside, which is the oddity, the historical oddity of the state as explicitly promising security. There's a wonderful book on security by John Hamilton, which talks about, in fact, for long tracts of human history, not only is security never guaranteed, it's actually almost sinful, because to assume that one is without care as a human being in the world is an almost blasphemous assertion, you know, that I alone am not only entitled to be protected from all harm, but someone actually could do that, you know. And so the state's claim, the state's move on the provision of security is such an interesting one.
It does very much fit into this idea of the idealized parent.
Yes, yes. But also the impossible ask. You know, because one thing, if you want to spend endless amounts of money on military toys, security is the word you want, because it can by definition never be satisfied.
Never be reached.
You know?
So if half of it was taking taking the idea of security by definition away from states without any interest in what states were actually doing, the other half of the equation is the attribution of terrorism to people who don't have states.
Yes, exactly.
So the other half of that is saying, and it's kind of interesting, because if they don't have a state, what else do they have? I mean, they don't have standard state-based weaponry. So the idea would be that they would use what they have available. I mean, that is Mao's argument when he writes on guerrilla war. You know, we're going to take the long road because this is what we have. So how do those things get also wed in such a way that seems so totally convincing?
Well, think of what it would be to replace the phrase "we don't negotiate with terrorists" by the phrase "we don't negotiate with people who are advocating an alternative political order for themselves." Those are very different statements.
Yes.
One has enormous emotional persuasiveness in today's climate, and the other does not. And yet, that's what really is being said. When I say I don't negotiate, I mean, you know, we all know one week you're a terrorist and the next week you're a freedom fighter.
Right. Sometimes the same day.
Osama bin Laden himself worked for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan under CIA funding.
Well, we're used to that in religion, because we have people like Jimmy Jones, who one day was going to the White House and was setting up a utopia, and the next day was considered to be a nut. So these things happen quite quickly. So if we go back to that tremendously successful rhetorical moment that we saw in the French Revolution, we're now seeing it with Netanyahu in a way you're kind of saying this is the modern version, and that somehow with this book he cemented a kind of discourse.
He did, but he couldn't have done it if history hadn't been on his side, you see. I mean, I've written a book which says something very different, but my book isn't going to have that kind of influence. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, it's not.
So what did he have on his side?
He had power.
Right.
And he had the vested interests of the global hegemony. The global hegemony does not want to talk about terror in the way that you and I are talking about it.
Well, no. I would say in addition to that, I would say he also had emotion on his side. I think that's also very important to bring you back, because you mentioned that. And clearly it's much easier to get emotionally involved in the power of language, even if it is to be frightened by it, than it is to have what we would, an intellectual conversation about how words have meaning. And I wonder whether there isn't also, and you touch on this a little bit when you touch on emotion. We have so many studies today, Ekman being an example, that I feel reduce emotion so tremendously. And that usually when people have a very strong emotion, from my Freudian point of view, it's never only one thing. That emotion is always a mixture.
Of course.
So I asked somebody if they could think of an example of sort of sublime terror. And he said that the example he was given was in the movie King Kong, when King Kong is at the top of the building holding Fay Wray. Okay, so if that's correct, I must say I may not have that example exactly
that's
correct.
Right.
So there, think of the complexity of that emotional feeling of terror. It's also excitement,
Yeah.
It's also love, attachment. Yeah. It's all those things all mixed up together.
Yeah.
And maybe what we do is we are so flattened when you and I have these intellectual conversations about terror that, you know, that seems to me, again, another dimension. It's very hard to combat that mixture of emotions.
Of course. And you know, you lead me, you invite me to recall Edmund Burke again, not this time as the critic of the French Revolution, but as the theorist of the sublime.
Mm-hmm.
It was in 1757, Burke's treatise on the sublime and the beautiful makes terror the key ingredient to the experience of the sublime, and the experience of the sublime aesthetically is pleasurable.
Yes.
So it's only after the revolution that you can't do that. Before the revolution, it's there as a positive aesthetic thing, a desirable experience, just as we might enjoy a roller coaster ride or a horror movie, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't say that now because the word has been suborned by other people. But Burke is creating a world in, you know, the 18th century intellectual, on the side of the belles lettres, would have a notion of terror that's primarily aesthetic, not political.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that there isn't still the status terror that Hobbes writes about. There is, but the primary signifier would have been aesthetic.
Well, maybe aesthetic terror still lives on.
Indeed, and remember the responses to 9/11, where people were uncomfortable at finding this odd, this endless reiteration of the falling towers. If not beautiful, and certainly addictive and mesmerizing,
mm-hmm.
you know.
There's clearly more to the emotion than we want to admit.
Yes.
But one could say that maybe you can't do as much with that if you're the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can do a lot with that if you're a movie director, you know. Mm-hmm. But if you're the state, you have to make certain other kinds of moves around the question of terror.
Well, the state doesn't want ambiguity.
Exactly. It doesn't want to deal in that Freudian way with the mixture, kind of emotions where we actually live in that way. So so where does that leave us now? Now we're left with the question of whether is terror per se always part of social organization then? I mean, we seem to be batting it back and forth between the state and the non-state entities, but we've never said it wasn't part of social organization. And you do address that some modern thinkers do think that there is a built-in part of terror to just living as a group of people, whether and certainly of people who might be trying to bring about a big change.
But others don't. And I think my view is that this is all, not all, I'm not. You know, I can't tell the difference between the cultural and the universal, and nor can anybody else, despite all the efforts made to do so. For instance, I don't know if you got far enough to read the stuff on the Cold War.
Yes.
But there, to my surprise, I discovered that the Eisenhower government during the 50s was not using the word terror. They were talking about panic.
Yes.
And that's a very different discussion. And I went through all that literature. I found it absolutely fascinating. It just simply doesn't go to terror.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole set of arguments around why that might be. We can leave those aside. But so it isn't that emotions are in some sense fixed and permanent and always there. It's that they are always that certain inchoate emotions belonging perhaps to the anxiety group. Be they weak or be they strong, everything from concern to terror, you know, that certain groups of emotions are open to redefinition by whoever it is, whether it's by psychologists, by academic theorists.
Or people writing pamphlets on what to do
exactly.
in case of nuclear war.
The Age of Anxiety, the Cold War theorist, Sylvan Tompkins with his emotions, Lacan with his angoisse, you know.
Yes.
It goes on and on and on. And when you start looking at all these words together, you realize that none of them defines anything, actually. What they reflect is the attempts of various subcultures to specify an experience as one thing and not another.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're negating as much as they are.
So by saying, you know, I'm experiencing terror, I'm making the claim, or somebody's making it for me, that I'm not experiencing anxiety.
Or panic,
right. Yeah. Which are panic, not necessarily less intense, but anxiety almost always less intense.
Mm-hmm.
And fear, somewhere less intense than terror, but maybe more intense than anxiety. Concern, less intense still. Mm-hmm. Concern is a great word. We should use it more.
Yes.
Because it's very ambiguous.
Yes, yes. No, I understand that. And I think anybody interested in sort of analytic discourse, like I've been interested in, that the palette is very, very yeah. rich. The palette is full of colors that we don't, when we yeah. hear the word and we're not even sure what exactly yeah. it is. So if we're talking then again about what is repressed when we use the word terror, possible things like love, attachment, pleasure. One of the other things which you mentioned very briefly at the beginning and don't come back to, but I wonder whether it's also part of the repression of terror, is the word race. That yeah. race is something that is part of terror, but it's the unspoken part because it actually doesn't ever get said out loud.
Yeah. It did after the slave revolts in the Caribbean in the 19th century. Mm. And the publicity around Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey and lots of other slave revolts in the U.S., they were described in the press as agents of terror and presenting the threat of terror to the mainstream U.S., mm-hmm. Particularly after the Haitian Revolution, when a lot of the owners came to the U.S., having mm-hmm. been moved out of Santo Domingo, and ended up basically relocating in the American South. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, in this country, above all, the experience of terror has always been associated with and blamed upon the racial
right.
other. But of course, as you know, ironically, it's the black man being stopped by the cop who's going to feel terror.
Exactly.
Not the cop.
Right. And I was trying to differentiate between what I would call the explicit use yeah. of race and yeah. what I said, what's repressed.
Yep.
That I think maybe one of the functions of terror that we don't totally understand is that it permits us to talk about race without making it explicit.
Yes, yes. And I think you can see that right now, that the Trump administration's rhetorically has not advanced the level of terror talk much beyond where it was with Bush. But it's so much a fixity now in the language that he's created an atmosphere in which terror is committed by particularly white nationalists now at the moment.
Yes.
A kind of response to the prospect of being terrorized. You know, it's weird.
It is. Well, in that way, it takes us very much back to your example from France,
yeah.
where that seems to have so much, illuminate so much about what happens,
yeah.
which is that, you know, the projection, we could call it in a Freudian sense, where you take yeah. something and you project it onto somebody else as a way of getting rid of your own terror.
Yeah.
And it actually works quite well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. I mean, some of these defense mechanisms that Freud talked about
yeah.
actually seem to work quite well and
yeah.
are quite difficult to undo
yeah.
because it permits you to engage in things that you're not even aware
yeah.
of. And so it yeah. permits you to use a discourse like terror, which
yeah.
seems like, as you say, who's going to raise their hand and say,
yeah.
I'm in favor of terrorism.
Yeah, yeah. exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of a one-way kind of discourse.
Yeah.
So, okay, yeah. so now we're left with all of these problems. So the question then is, where do we go from here, or how do we go from here? The first thing I guess we do is we go back and we redo history, and we redo literature, and we go back and we plumb all of this text, as you do, just to make the point of how rich and diverse words are throughout their history.
Mm.
And maybe that's just like the first thing that mm. we say.
Critical and philology.
Exactly. Mm. But we say that it fills an important task. It's an important task. And somebody has to have the time and the knowledge to go back and retrieve that all for us. Do you say that's sort of like task one?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you've done that for us, luckily. So because you read all of this stuff. So now we come here. How do we see the power of words, but... and I understand that one of the things you're going to talk about is the limitations of power. And that's clear that
mm-hmm.
that the limitations of our power mm-hmm. are going to be severe. You and I aren't going to go out tonight and write something for Murdoch that's going mm-hmm. to instantaneously go around
yeah.
the world. But given the limitations that we have, what do we do as to try to do two things, it seems to me. One is to have more room to think
mm-hmm.
and less room to emote.
Mm-hmm.
around terror. Mm-hmm. That instead of getting swept up in the emotions of it, we actually are trying to have an intellectual conversation about it. And that actually is much more difficult than I think people realize.
But that's also one of the crucial things that the university makes possible. The university, the college, or even the high school. It doesn't have to be the university. It doesn't have to be California. That's what education is at all levels. That cannot be given up on if we have a hope. You know, if we're all going to die in the wilderness, as Matthew Arnold said, we have to have at least left some signposts for, you know, where to go next and how to go there. And I think education is the answer. Education, education, education. Doesn't matter what form it comes in. I mean, mine happens to be largely addressed to people like myself and students and probably more graduate students than undergraduates, but nonetheless, you know, it's very important to help people feel they're not alone. If anybody's having these thoughts or even capable of having these thoughts or interested in pursuing them, it's very encouraging not to feel you're doing it on your own.
Yes.
At the same time, you raise a question about accountability, which has been on my mind a lot. I was fortunate enough to spend 3 months at the Center for Advanced Research in Stellenbosch in South Africa last year or the year before. And it's an interdisciplinary environment largely dominated by people doing real hands-on outcome-oriented work like working on malaria or water supply or this, that, or in the South African constitution. Moments where intellectuals can feel that they have a hands-on relationship to what's actually happening in the world. A lot of scientists have that. You know, they know that what they're doing, even if it's running failed experiments and no one else has to do, they know they're making a contribution. I think with people like us, it's much harder.
Yes.
And so one can get into a state of despair, and I've certainly been there.
No, I think that's very true. And I do think we often go back to our teaching as a way of kind of reinvigorating ourselves and seeing that somebody is listening. I think the image you've given us of these this work as a signpost that other people can look at, I think that's also very important. And maybe one thing we can do that the people who are studying malaria can't do, not that what they're doing is not important, it's absolutely vital, but we can work with language. And I do think that's kind of where you begin the book, and that's kind of where I would sort of like to think a little bit at the end of our conversation. I had a wonderful, I heard from D.A. Powell, the poet, did this wonderful discussion. He said that poets are the kidneys of language. That we take words that are all encrusted, and we take off the encrustments, and we send them out shiny new for people to use. And it struck me when you were mentioning poetry as a way of revitalizing, and that's why I was interested in the novel as well. And you brought up then poetry. These are there are spaces in society where we can revitalize language. Let's put the classroom in there. Why not? Let's put the classroom. But there are also other spaces.
And they have different durations, different temporalities. So, you know, you publish a book. Paradise Lost did not sell out its first edition in Milton's lifetime. Can you imagine that? Pete Keats made no money from his, from
that's
his poems.
Famous. Yes.
His editors funded them and they never got their money back. If you write a book, even a humble academic book, it's there for somebody to pick up in a world you cannot know.
I think that's also the signpost, the legacy. I think those are a wonderful thing. Are there any other thoughts that you want to leave the listeners with about how we, I suppose we start by paying attention, by just making a decision we're going to pay attention to the words that we use. And we're also going to just acknowledge straightforward, which I'm happy to do, how powerful the words are. So we're going to say that it isn't only finding cure for disease, it's how we talk about disease, and that we specialize in this, and that first we have to just pay more attention to the words. Beyond paying attention, do you have any other advice or just thoughts that we can leave the listeners with to what are they going to do with the word terror now when they go out and they're going to run into it, believe you me, probably on the news tonight?
I hope what they're going to do is say, who's using this word and what are they trying to do to me?
Right. And then they'll say, I'm not feeling terrorized. The first thing to do is to kind of disassociate yourself from the feeling of terror, and then say, for whose good is this use
who
of terror?
Who wants me to feel terror?
Who wants me to feel terrorized?
Who wants me to acknowledge the power of terror here?
Yes. Okay, well, we're leaving our listeners then with the call to be very calm until next week, okay?
No but, thinking but very of, vigilant.
Very vigilant and also very careful. That's a lot of things to do, to be very careful about language and pay attention to the power of it. In the meantime, they will be able to find a link to your website and more information about your book because that will be posted on our archive. So our listeners are always welcome to go to officehourucdpodcast.com. That's officehourucdpodcast.com. And this show will be there, and you can listen to it again. And you can find links to David Simpson's website, and you will also be able to listen to past shows as well. So I want to thank you very much, David, for coming on the show. It's great film. I don't feel terrorized at all. I feel totally ready to go out and fight the fight. And and so join us next week. We'll be back again. We'll have another. We'll knock on somebody else's door, and we'll find out something else about research going on at the University of California, Davis. Until then, go out and be calm.